Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Today we continue our conversation with Fintan Dunn from Ireland, who's an online journalist, a geopolitical analyst, and the editor of the internet radio show Break for News. Fintan has two other online websites, fintandunn.com, that's FintanDunne.com, and treeincarnation.com. Yesterday, we were going to continue our discussion about misinformation and disinformation in the 9/11 research community, but we had technical problems making contact with Fintan, so I invited him back today, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back. Fintan, welcome back to the Dynamic Duo.
How are you doing, Jim? And I hope you're hearing me loud and clear. How am I coming over?
You know, it's a nice day to have you back to talk about these things because, of course, we have been the recipients of this reported confession from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to everything that has ever happened in the last 20 years, everything bad. It's quite a ridiculous situation before this combatant status review tribunal, which actually has the narrow task of determining whether he was properly designated as an enemy combatant. Nevertheless, they've released a transcript in which he confessed to some 30 different kinds of plots and says that he was responsible for the death of 3,000 Americans. He said, I was responsible for the 9/11 operation from A to Z. What's your take on this, Fintan?
Well, you know, one part of that is ludicrously funny. And only, to my knowledge, the Independent in the United Kingdom reported that properly by saying the U.S. claims, and they used the word alleged confession, because of course we've no verification other than the word of the U.S. military who are in control of that situation. The other side of it is not funny at all, and I regard that as a blood-stained alleged confession, because it's stained with the blood of the suffering of the many individuals who are incarcerated with ruthless denial of their civil liberties and what is clearly treatment that violates Geneva Convention and violates all human rights principles. So it's both ludicrous and tragic, Jim.
Ridiculous, in fact. He even said, and it was reported in the article in the New York Times about this, that while he had previously made confessions under torture that he would now deny, he says that what he's saying today, even though he wasn't speaking under oath and claiming his religious beliefs prohibited it, what he was saying was true. And yet even the 9/11 Commission said he was noted for his extravagant ambitions, using his initials, described his vision as a theater, a spectacle of destruction, with KSM as a self-cast star, the super terrorist, where even the 9/11 Commission wasn't willing to take anything he had to say at face value. Of course, it's quite an absurd confession on its face. A friend of mine at noon with whom I had lunch just happened to type out his top 10 reasons for not believing the confession, including that he hasn't explained how he's able to get explosives into Building 7. He hasn't explained how he's able to divert the U.S. military away from the Pentagon, that he's been locked up for years without basic constitutional rights. All we know about him is from a press release, which is not itself a form of evidence. Osama, of course, was alleged to have claimed to have planned it, but you and I both know he denied it initially. And if he denied it, and his denial was legitimate, which certainly appears to be the case, it wouldn't appear as though what Mohammed is saying could possibly be true. He's confessed to at least four sensational terrorist attacks, the 93 bombing, the 9/11, the shoe bomber, and even the beheading of Daniel Pearl. So maybe if we got this guy, we can just stop the war on terrorism after all. At the behest of Pakistani General Mohammed wired $100,000 to the cocaine pork chop lap dancing Islamic fundamentalist terrorist Mohammed Atta on September 6, 2001. That was quite a nice case where the general was having a breakfast in Washington, D.C. with Porter Gross and the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee when these events went down. Here's one he added that I thought was rather amusing, that Muhammad never said he said poet in his confession. It's really quite ridiculous.
Well, yeah, and even that alleged $100,000 transfer, I'm deeply suspicious of, because it does, of course, point us in the direction of the approved patsies. It establishes, to those of us who are awake, some kind of a causal evidence chain. But at the same time, it is, in the end, only pointing us towards the prearranged patsies who supposedly carried out the attacks. So I don't believe really anything that comes out of the U.S. administration or the Pentagon. And I think that they're continually massaging events just for propaganda and for diversionary purposes, Jim, to throw us off the scent and to spin things. But of all of their pronouncements,
I think they're geniuses at public relations and the politics of distraction, Fenton. That's absolutely right. This is a Karl Rove's area of specialization, so I couldn't agree more. Well, listen, we were just beginning to talk about your take about the role of disinformation in the research community, and I really want to give you ample opportunity to lay out your take, because it seems to me you have a very distinctive point of view.
Okay, well, we covered, if you like, one of the legs of the stool I've got here. It's a five-legged stool, and I'd like to lay out the basis of disinformation analysis so that we can understand where it's coming from and then apply that to the 9/11 issue. Across the political manipulation of free elections, across this spin-meistering, the Karl Roveism and total news management, across the use of psychological warfare, across fake politics and globalization and the globalization agenda. And if we examine each of those areas, we see them coming together and giving us an understanding of where we've got to in these totally media-misled days where information warfare is everything and disinformation is all over the 9/11 issue.
Okay, we have talked about globalization during our first interview. Perhaps enough has been said for the moment that we know that in your view, that is the ultimate goal here, to where the G8 and the World Trade Organization really create a scenario under which corporations are ruling the world. But in order to get there, lots of things have to happen. And it looks, I take it in your view, as though 9/11 was a key event in order to manipulate the situation, in order to lead the world, but especially the United States, in that direction.
Yeah, and one of the key pieces of disinformation, which is within the 9/11 issue, is that it's designed to smear the blame across the neocons, Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and portray this as some kind of a grand military neocon adventure, which was engineered into place by the 9/11 event. Whereas, in fact, it's much deeper than that. And, in fact, this is designed to be suspected by people internationally that those were the people behind it. Whereas, in fact, there's a much broader agenda which has to do with demonizing the U.S. government, with breaking the confidence of the people of the United States in their own government and system of government, and then shepherding them in the direction of a good cop, bad cop, where the good cop is going to be Hillary Clinton, perhaps with Barack Obama as a vice presidential candidate, ushering us into this new era of globalization. So there's patsies all over the place in this one, Jim, and the neocons are some of the biggest patsies going. So key disinformation in the 9/11 issue has been just to smear us.
In the direction of believing that Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and Donald Feith and Paul Wolfowitz and General Richard Meyer and Condoleezza Rice and Rudy Giuliani and Larry Silverstein were the principals here, with the possibility of outsourcing perhaps the destruction of the World Trade Center to some Israeli operatives. I mean, that's the way it's shaped up in terms of my own research, so I'm very interested in learning why you think that might be a superficial account or only barely skimming the surface. We'll be right back with my special guest, Fenton Dunn from Ireland. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Dynamic Duo.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see. All your life, you You are only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird, fly. Blackbird, fly. Into the line of a dark black night.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today is Fenton Dunn, and we're discussing information, misinformation, disinformation in relation to the 9/11 research community. And Fenton, before we go too far into your analysis of the background and the motives and the players behind the scenes, perhaps you could give us a sketch of what you take to be the case as to the events that transpired on 9/11. What actually happened there?
I'm not really prepared to do that, you know. I would have to, you know, sit down and work through that, Jim.
Oh, well, what I meant was just in a broad scale. Would you be inclined to agree with me that, for example, the Twin Towers were blown up by a very sophisticated technique, probably using unconventional methods, more or less from the top down, that their destruction was faster than free fall would have been possible, that Building 7 was a separate event, probably with conventional explosives, that the massiveness of the destruction of the World Trade Center pretty much precludes explaining what happened there on the basis of conventional demolition of the Twin Towers by itself, that in the Pentagon it's pretty obvious that a Boeing 757 didn't hit the building, that it may have been some combination of a smaller plane and possibly a missile or two fired into the building. And in Shanksville things are pretty mysterious because that hole in the ground looks more like it was created by a bulldozer digging a ditch, filling it with trash and blowing it up than it does that any plane crashed there. In fact, the debris field and so forth might be consistent with a plane being shot down since it's distributed over something like 8 square miles, but there's also the possibility that that flight actually landed at the Cleveland airport. A lot of this is shrouded in mist, but it's pretty obvious that what the government has told us in every major respect about 9/11 is false.
Well, I'd agree with you on that point in terms of the falseness of the official story, but I really am not prepared tonight to go into details on that. That's something we're still investigating in the 9/11 3i investigation on breakfornews.com, and we haven't reached firm conclusions there about any of the events, but we're certainly examining the evidence.
Okay.
But, I'd really like to just get, you know,
that's fine. That's fine. I just wanted to know where we, you know, where we stood vis-a-vis the conclusions toward which I and members of scholars have been driven, which are summarized on Scholars for 9/11 Truth, the 9/11scholars.org website. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, just in laying out, you know, the whole context in which we're operating, I'd like to examine a number of key areas, and I think this will illuminate it for us, and we'll see then the nature of disinformation and how you apply it, how you use it. And the first area is the trend towards the political manipulation of free elections. Now, this is something we've seen abroad, Jim. I'm sure people are very familiar with the Orange Revolution, which took place in Ukraine. But, in fact, there have been color-coded revolutions all across Eastern Europe, including Kyrgyzstan and Georgia. And the organizations active in those areas are outreach groups from the Republican and Democratic parties in the United States. I'm talking about the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs, the National Endowment for Democracy, the International Republican Institute, and George Soros' Open Society Institute. And if you examine the functions of those organizations, they're not helping to spread democracy. They're helping to spread a particular kind of democracy that suits Western corporate interests. That's particularly evident in Eastern Europe. But these same groups are active also in Iraq. And their activities essentially are the front end of covert activities, which used to be entirely the ambit of the CIA. In the past, the CIA used to manipulate the democratic process in foreign countries and do so covertly. But, of course, that came to light in the 70s to a great extent. And so what's happened now is that you have these front organizations which manipulate the democratic process, and behind the scenes you have the CIA doing the usual dirty tricks operations. The danger is, and the problem we have is, that they have now turned those techniques and tactics of manipulating foreign democratic processes onto the scene in particularly the United States, the United Kingdom, and Australia, the heart of the Anglo-American Australian alliance behind the war on terror. And they're using the same tactics to manipulate the electoral processes at home. And they've gotten pretty good at this. They know how to fire up political activists. Suppose they need an issue to get some guy who's a leader in a foreign country unpopular. They can manufacture an issue. They can create groups on the ground who will go out and protest. They create websites. They build up a head of steam. They get everybody out in the streets with orange flags or blue flags or red flags. And before you know it, you have a so-called popular revolution. They're really good at this. And that is the context in the United States in particular, against which we have to judge disinformation, is that it's happening such that political activists on both sides of the Democratic-Republican divide in the United States can be manipulated and are being manipulated behind the scenes. So that, if you like, is one key leg of this stool I've got of disinformation.
Well, there's certainly, I think, a growing awareness in the United States that the use of electronic voting machines, for example, by private corporations that have close ties to the Bush administration has been benefiting the Republican Party by something like a 5% slant in those cases when there's no paper trail. There's quite a lot about this and their role in the elections of 2002-2004. I mean, in Georgia, when Max Cleland lost his Senate seat, the situation was ridiculous. He went into Election Day with something like a 14% lead and wound up losing, nevertheless, by voting machines, which were displaying patterns of report that were consistent with manipulation. Florida, of course, was a nice example of theft of an election where the Supreme Court itself intervened, and it will, I think, be the blackest mark in the history of the court when it didn't allow the state of Florida to proceed with its own processes of evaluating the votes and determining its own electors in order to have a legitimate outcome. But I wonder, you know, apart from that, what precisely are you suggesting? I agree with the pattern you're talking about for, you know, fomenting discontent and having so-called, you know, uprisings, popular uprisings and so forth, which of course was attempted unsuccessfully against Hugo Chavez a couple of times here. He's now been, of course, elected three times by very large margins to be the leader of Venezuela. I'm just wondering what we should look for, Fintan, as signs of this kind of manipulation of our representatives.
Okay, well, you touched on one issue there, for example, which is the widely discussed in the alternative media, at least, manipulation of the electoral system by interfering with voting machines and having insecure voting machines, etc.
Hold that thought, Fintan. We'll be right back with my special guest, Fintan Dunn from Ireland. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. We're discussing disinformation in relation to 9/11 research and related aspects, what's really going on, the underlying significance of the events of 9/11, with Fintan Dunn from Ireland. Fintan, I'd like you to pick up where we left off before the break.
Okay, so we see there the first leg of that stool is political manipulation of free elections, and we're already talking about the subversion of democracy, because you're not supposed to be doing that. And an example of how that is disinformation is the stolen election issue, which we think we're onto something that tells us something about what's going on, is in fact being used simply to drive potential democratic voters into the hands of the Democratic Party, by reminding them that, hey, their election got stolen before, don't let it happen again, get out and vote for Hillary next time in 08. So the second leg of the stool, then, is the emergence of this whole era of spinmeistering, the Karl Rove type era, and it's typified by being able to spin the news cycle to a particular political advantage. And I think that they've developed that forward to the point now that you don't just try to spin on a day-to-day basis, but that you're spinning to a news agenda, something I'd call total news management. So what comes out of the major media, and if you get the major media on board, you're talking about maybe the New York Times, Washington Post, Chicago Tribune, LA Times, and you've really got it all in the bag. And what happens is that they're generating so-called news, which is actually custom designed by operators behind the scenes who are making sure that in instead of the danger of us maybe talking about real issues that we care about, they will feed us a relentless diet of prepared news items. So that's a very important skill that they have, which they add to this other skill of the manipulation of political activists, including 9/11 activists. Then the third leg of the stool is psychological warfare and the revolution in military affairs, which really is a total rethink of military affairs by the military themselves and indeed by the people who manipulate the political process in the US and 9/11, so that they're oriented towards information warfare all the time. They're focusing on that, and that's their key paradigm all the time, is the psychological effect they're having on the target audience. And once again, these were skills developed for deployment abroad, which have been turned on the people of the United States themselves. When you take those three legs together, you end up with a fourth one. You end up with the potential of adding this political manipulation, total news management, and psychological warfare control to create fake politics, completely, totally fake politics, where you have the Republican and Democratic senior levels who are working hand in hand, and they're simply batting back and forward the electors between the two parties, alternating over long cycles of perhaps 8 to 10, 12 years between the two parties, and that's totally engineered, and all of the politics is totally fake. And I would include in that, as a classic example on that, the plane affair, which I see as a totally fake, contrived scandal. One designed to fill the news pages with, well, something safe, because they're in control of that. And my illustration of how in control of that they are is just take a look at some of the players. Take a look at, say, Patrick Fitzgerald. He played a role in the prosecutions in relation to the first attack on the World Trade Center in 1993. He prosecuted Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman, Patrick Fitzgerald. He shows up again in relation to the Plamegate affair. Another guy who shows up is a judge looking after the case, and that's Reggie Walton. And he was appointed by Reagan and by George Bush Sr. Curiously, that same judge also shows up in a 9/11 related case, which is the Sybelle Edmonds case. He was the one who was overseeing the right of the government to gag Sybelle Edmonds in that case. And there are other people who show up in relation to this and who seem to keep on coming back into the same stories. We've got, for example, that same judge, Reggie Walton, showing up as the presiding judge in the Hatfield case on the anthrax issue. So I'm suggesting that we've got a number of key players. Here's somebody else who shows up with it, Mark Zaid, who is a lawyer representing Sybelle Edmonds. He also shows up in the Tony Schaefer case in relation to this alleged surveillance of Mohammed Atta. So I'm pointing to a short list of key characters who are showing up in a number of key cases, and I'm saying that that's happening because they are safe hands in which the establishment places these issues, knowing that they're safe, knowing that the individuals who are prosecuting or judging those cases are safe hands and will not take the case anywhere they don't want it taken, and so they can have a totally fake story. So those are the key tactics which can be applied in order to create fake stories around the 9/11 issue based on the skills they have built up in creating a completely fake political structure. And that's my background, Jim.
Well, that's quite fascinating. And, of course, some five corporations now control 90% of the news. A lot of us are convinced that talk radio and the Internet are the only last bastions of free speech and free inquiry left in the United States. But certainly the sketch you're portraying sounds very plausible. Where would you carry us from there?
Well, in fact, just while we're on it, let's talk about the Internet. Because these guys saw the Internet coming, too. They knew that the Internet was going to be a threat. So they have acted to minimize the potential threat of the Internet. And it's not that difficult to do. I know we have a lot of freedom on the Internet, but by the same token, a relatively small investment was all that was required in media terms for them to control the key traffic points on the Internet. Of course, the mainstream media are heavily on the Internet as well. But I think that they have had a long-term campaign. For example, let's look at the Chinese. Chinese, we know, have something in the order of 30,000 internet police who monitor the internet to see what's going on in it. And I'm suggesting that perhaps the Western intelligence agencies are not quite so shy either. Just they do it behind the scenes, and they do it not so much by controlling what you say as by pumping money into front organizations which populate the internet and make sure that, at least in the high traffic zones, that they've got it covered. And I think the implications of that for the 9/11 issue are that they knew the 9/11 issue was going to come at them on the internet too, and they made sure to be well in place years beforehand with assets on the internet that would control the debate. And that as soon as 9/11 happened, that an action plan kicked into gear to divert us in key ways, and that's something I'd like to get into as we go along in looking at the key diversion tactics which they then applied on the internet in order to throw us off the scent.
Well, I think that's very appropriate and right where we want to go, because it's identifying those sources and individuals who appear, in your view, to be steering the discussion and debate about 9/11, that may be the key to understanding what's going on, if your premises are correct. So take us there.
Yeah, well, everybody has a point of view on who might be steering people right or wrong, and it's right that people should have a debate on that issue. What I'd like to do in the first instance is at least establish the trends, the kind of tricks that are being pulled, and then let people make their own judgments. I think one of the first things was to point us in the wrong direction, to make sure that we did not focus on the globalization agenda of the 9/11 attacks, and instead were focused on the American military and neocons as the prime progenitors of it.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Fit and Dunn. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo.
Hey, Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better. Remember to let her into your heart. Then you can start to make it better. Hey Jude, don't be afraid. You were made to go out and get her. The minute you let her under your skin, then you begin to make it better.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett. Today my special guest is Fit and Dunn, and we're talking about the five legs of his psychological war paradigm. Fit, why don't you reiterate those five legs and then continue discussing the leg you're pursuing now.
Okay, well, really it all comes together. Here we are, the 9/11 event arrives, and we are in deep trouble because they have got political manipulation, so they are well-versed in how to push us around like sheep. They are well-versed in spin and total news management, so they can hit us with a wall of pre-prepared news, and they understand the value of psychological warfare techniques in terms of how they control us and manipulate us. And they have a fake political system where the top levels of both Republican and Democratic parties are fully on board, and they have a globalization agenda running, which they are carefully concealing in terms of portraying the United States as the bad guy internationally. And we saw that played out in the United Nations, etc., where the other countries, such as France and Russia, etc., Germany even to an extent, put up what seemed like spirited defense of Iraq's right to self-determination. But when it came right down to it, they just signed up with the rest of the G8 at the Dayton, Ohio G8 meeting. So we really didn't have a chance in many ways. And the tactics they used, the first tactics I'd identified that they used against us was psychological warfare in terms of fear. Basically, they psyched us out. The idea was to get us thinking emotionally rather than logically. When you think logically, you're going to arrive at good conclusions. Whereas when you're reacting emotionally, you're not. And so they pushed our buttons in order to get us reacting emotionally. And one of the techniques used there was the creation of Abu Ghraib prison and that scandal of prisoner mistreatment, designed to paint the U.S. in a bad light internationally, but at the same time acting as a sort of a fear agenda to say, just like down with Gitmo, that you cross us, you're going to end up in some wire cage where we will ruthlessly abuse you. So that set a sort of fear agenda. We had a lot of other fear agendas, too, running around the idea that they were going to declare martial law, etc. None of that happened, of course, but back at the time, it got everybody reacting emotionally. And then they presented us with a cast of cardboard cutout bad guy characters, quintessentially Bernard Kerik. I mean, what a low life. But these are the guys that they put up there. Chertoff, another low life. Rumsfeld, Cheney. These were people who were easily despicable, and they played upon that in order to sucker us into getting angry against certain individuals who were only the front men and missing the bigger picture. The next thing they did, of course, was...
Just for a clarification, Fenton, when you're talking about they, we may need a little more, you know, commentary there. I know ultimately you think G8 and the bankers and so forth and the big corporations are responsible, but is there an intermediate entity? Is there something like the Council on Foreign Relations or some comparable entity that you would attribute with the role of planning these things out and casting roles for these different characters to play?
Well, you know, a central role has got to be played by some elements who are either in or have left U.S. intelligence. There's no doubt about that. But I wouldn't see the operational control of that level of the script as coming out of what you would classically define as the CIA. Even though I call this the CIA fakes, and you can Google that term and find the article, that's just a shorthand. I believe that many of the key players at the operational level are extra-governmental, but would have a track record within organizations such as the U.S. and British intelligence services. However, if you like, certain objectives are desired by the international corporate elite, and certain other people make sure that those objectives are met. And nobody who likes to go home and kiss their daughter goodnight and tuck them in really wants to know the details. And they don't have to, because the details are handled by the guys who don't mind getting their hands dirty with that kind of work. So,
during the second hour, let's come back to the CIA fakes, because your rogues gallery is quite an impressive list. Some of these people I know personally, and I have questions about some of your, you know, some of those that you're identifying in that way. But let's continue right now with the broader picture of the five legs.
Okay. So, a key tactic then is getting us emotionally reacting and pointing us in the wrong direction towards the cardboard cutout characters, the bad guys. Then divide and conquer. Split the movement up at all, at every opportunity and at each opportunity, into my hop and into lie hop, into every way, into the Jews did it and the Jews didn't do it. And any other way you can cut the movement up, it all helps. Another key objective of the disinformation is contaminate the evidence. Get us to take on board evidence that is flimsy or evidence that is totally fake. And in that, I would include the insertion of false evidence. This is something that many 9/11 activists have missed out on. That it's not a question of that you might spot things that happened on 9/11, which you're getting on to something they didn't want you to find out. It's more a question that ambiguous material is deliberately inserted into it in order to throw you off the track, in order to feed you a red herring which takes you down a route that leads you nowhere. And that's also tied to another key objective, which is to waste your time. Simply waste your time to get you to spend a lot of time, energy, and interest on so-called evidence which actually leads nowhere. And
Do you have some specific examples you'd like to offer of those techniques?
The classic example of the time waste is everything that happened down in Florida, which Dan Hofstetter reported that Amanda Keller was saying. And Amanda Keller said she had a relationship with Muhammad Atta. Dan Hofstetter reported extensively on this. And then what we had happened subsequently, after, you know, pages and pages and pages and pages of stuff about Amanda Keller and how she was painting a picture of Muhammad Atta that was completely different than the government story, etc., etc., is it's quietly announced to the Florida press that Amanda Keller now says that it was a different Muhammad, and that she's now moving away somewhere else. She's going to get married, which means she's going to change her name, which means that we're going to follow that trail sometime in the future. All we're looking for is somebody called Amanda something, somewhere in America, who at one stage told Dan Hofstetter that Muhammad Atta was actually on cocaine. So we had an entire episode down there focused on Florida, which, of course, is where they wanted us to focus, where they said the Patsies had planned the attack, which turned into total vapor as our key witness upped and left town saying, by the way, it was a different Mohammed. Now, that's a classic example to me of wasting our time. And I was suspicious of Amanda Keller way back. I wrote about those suspicions, and when she came out in the Florida Press and announced that she was backing off the story, it confirmed my suspicions that we had lured a story. And it was a complete waste of our time. Nothing more and nothing less. The unfortunate thing is that it was corroborated to a degree by somebody I referred to earlier, which is Sybil Edmonds, who is gagged by the U.S. government, so she can't actually say anything, but nevertheless spins a lot of innuendo left, right, and center, and she was seen to substantiate elements of what Dan Hofstetter had been finding out about drug connections linked to the 9/11 issue. So I see that as another time waste, and as I said earlier, Sybil Edmonds, her case is overseen by the same judge who was looking over the Hatfield case and the same judge who was looking over the recent Plaingate case involving Patrick Fitzgerald. There's another example of time wasting. And that really has a big impact on us, because if you examine, say, popular forums, for example, Democratic Underground, you will find literally thousands of pages devoted to the issue of Amanda Keller, what she was saying about Mohammed Atta, and devoted to Sybil Edmonds and what she was saying. And that kind of stuff literally wastes our time. So there's some practical examples there. A whole range of tactics waste our time. And as I say, I'd like to return to this one again, contaminate the evidence pool by inserting what looks like tasty morsels of evidence. And that includes, for example, the pod underneath the planes.
Hold that thought, Denton. We'll be right back. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo, with my special guest, Denton Dunn. Stand by. Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett. Well, you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays, Fridays, and I'm here Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Today with my special guest, Fintan Dunn from Ireland, and we're discussing misinformation and disinformation in 9/11 research. Fintan, the example you're using of the pods is one that might be worth our discussing for a few minutes, because I think you can only offer it as an example of distraction if you're convinced that, in fact, it's a phony issue. I was in Chandler, Arizona with Dave Von Kleist and watched a presentation he made of parts of a new video where he was showing four different frames of the plane just before it hit the building from different perspectives. We talked a bit about the pods. I'm not convinced that they aren't bona fide features of those aircraft. Colonel George Nelson, with whom I made a presentation in front of the Alexandria Courthouse last April about the trial of Zacharias Moussaoui, said to me that those were non-standard features of the aircraft, and because a commercial airliner has to have a formal certification for any non-standard features, he was convinced that these were not the original aircraft, Flight 175 and Flight 11, that they were purported to be. So I have considered the possibility there's something called a flight termination system that allows an aircraft to have control overridden if it's being hijacked from the ground. Boeing refuses to talk about it or to identify what these features are. I just say to you that I'm not convinced this is a distraction, and it would seem to me we could only arrive at the conclusion that it is a distraction if we knew actually what those features are.
Well, yeah, it's certainly possible to engineer in the flight control systems into standard aircraft, which would enable you to essentially turn it into a cruise missile. to have an override system which would use a combination of normal cruise missile terrain-based tracking, followed by a switch over to a homing beacon as soon as you got in range of the towers. The disinformation content arises that people in the 9/11 movement don't seem to have considered the possibility that the government might deliberately insert flashes, insert ambiguous content into some of the video footage which is released about that day in order to deliberately seed what are essentially diversionary issues.
It might have, of course, but I don't know how we can conclude, at least initially, that was what was done. I mean, after all, it turns out we have FAA data on the deregistration of these planes. A plane that is involved in a crash would normally be decertified in something like 48 hours. Two of the four planes were not decertified until the year 2002, and the other two not until the year 2005, which means we have an awful lot of evidence that whatever planes may have been involved here, that they're almost certainly not the ones that they're purported to be.
Well, you know, it's very difficult to make these judgments. I mean, I think we have to be careful and cautious as we make these judgments because it's not just a question, as I say, of us uncovering information that they don't want us to find out, but it's also a question that any operation like this uses the same tactics as is used by a departing jet to make sure that nobody shoots it down with a stamp of a missile. What you do is the departing jet throws out a load of chaff, and the 9/11 operation threw out an enormous amount of chaff, which is distractionary information, so that you're, I call it the orgy of evidence, so that there is so much evidence that you don't know which stuff is the real stuff and which isn't. And that's not accidental. It's deliberate that they make sure that the evidence pool is huge, that there is literally an orgy of evidence, and much of it is contrived so that you can't the real from the fake.
Well, I might agree with that, Fenton. I mean, that's the whole purpose of research. I mean, the whole point in founding Scholars for 9/11 Truth a year ago, December, was to bring together experts in different areas to sort these things out. I created a research group back in 1992 to study the death of John F. Kennedy, and we discovered that most, not just a lot, but most of the evidence in this case was phony, fake, or fabricated. So believe me, I understand exactly the point you're making, but it ultimately can only be sorted out on the basis of objective scientific research.
Okay, I agree. Let me just touch on a couple of other areas and maybe come back to this issue of evidence.
Go ahead.
One of the other problems we have, and I'm sure you'll be aware of it as well, is that the media then cherry-pick what they want to cover out of all the evidence that is available. So they will traditionally pick some of the weakest points that are available. And the danger for us is that elements in the 9/11 movement have made a big play of issues which are essentially weak. One of the problems for us is that there is no central 9/11 movement administration, so anybody can go out there with information. And the danger is that some of that information is very flaky, and we'd often be much better restricting ourselves to what we can and cannot prove or establish beyond reasonable doubt, instead of broadening our case out so much so that when the mainstream media finally ambush us big time on primetime TV, they'll pick some of the flakiest stuff that's out there and they'll ignore the good quality evidence. Whereas if we were able to restrict ourselves to only good quality, demonstrable evidence, we'd be in a much better position.
Well, let me just say, if one is convinced, as I am convinced, that conventional explosives such as thermite, even if it were supplemented by something like RDX, cannot possibly account for even the destruction of the Twin Towers, much less the other buildings at the World Trade Center, then you're of necessity obligated to look at alternatives that may involve non-conventional explosives, things like nuclear weapons, whether atomic or hydrogen, maybe mini-nukes, or maybe lasers, or masers, or plasmoids. Now, this is an indispensable aspect of scientific research, Fenton. It's not a matter of being flaky. It's a matter of considering all the possible explanations that might be involved here. And having done quite a bit in this area and having been attacked quite a few times on this ground, I just must tell you that if you understand the nature of science, you appreciate that sometimes you got to look at hypotheses that may seem implausible or speculative in the beginning, and yet it may be necessitated by the evidence. I think if anyone who wants to go to my discussion of these matters from, 17 March, when I was in Columbus, maybe it was February, 17 Feb, I was in Columbus, and then the 24th in Phoenix, they can find on the website, 911scholars.org. Four YouTubes are all quite brief, where I'm laying out the reasons why, the kind of explanations that have been offered by Stephen Jones, for example, can't possibly be adequate, and why we have to look elsewhere. Now, that makes us vulnerable to the kind of cherry-picking or distortion you're talking about, but it's an essential part of science. I don't see how science can proceed if you don't consider all the available alternative hypotheses.
Yeah, well, I'd be in agreement on you there, and we've actually looked at the issue of whether there were esoteric or unknown in the public domain weaponry used in our own investigation on breakfornews.com. We just haven't reached any conclusion on that definitively. But I certainly defend anybody's right to examine those issues. It's in terms of making definitive conclusions that you've got to be careful until you have sufficient evidence to establish it beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, I couldn't agree more. In fact, in my own research, as you may or may not know, I mean, professionally, I am a philosopher of science. I've devoted 35 years of my life to teaching logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning. And that is a crucial issue on which I have focused, namely, what are the conditions of scientific reasoning, and under what conditions are you entitled to accept or reject, or should you hold in suspense an hypothesis? So that's absolutely crucial to scientific investigation. But just because you're looking at or considering or discussing hypotheses, that's a very different thing from drawing conclusions or accepting them as true, even if you're doing so in the fallible and tentative fashion characteristic of science. And there is where I think the other side, people who want to defend these conventional explanations that I'm convinced are hopelessly inadequate, have done a gross disservice to the 9/11 movement by suggesting that persons like me or Judy Wood or Morgan Reynolds, who are merely inviting the consideration of non-conventional alternatives, they're treating us as though we've committed ourselves to them, even as though we've committed ourselves to some specific version. That's where you get these hit interviews that are grossly misrepresenting the views of, say, Judy Wood, whom I consider to be the most qualified member of the 9/11 research community by virtue of her degrees in...
That it's evolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can cut me out? Don't you know it's gonna be alright? Alright.
Spencer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays, Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today is Fintan Dunn from Ireland, and we're talking about information, misinformation, disinformation in 9/11 research. Fintan, let me put my concern the other way around. I mean, I'm suggesting in the case of the pods, it can be very difficult to sort out whether it's somebody might be mistaken, or whether they could be deliberately misleading, or whether they might be onto something. Now you're talking about, some speculation. I presume you're talking about the possibility that directed energy weapons could have been used at the World Trade Center, which I'm convinced is the case. But what I want to ask you is this. You suggest that we ought to focus on non-controversial or settled issues, but I'm not clear which you take those to be. Can you help me understand what you think are the issues that ought to be focused on because you think they've been established beyond a reasonable doubt?
Okay. Well, I'll give it an example of that, and it touches on the issue of the destruction of the three buildings on 9/11, the Twin Towers and Building 7, which is that three buildings fell there on that day where there is no substantive cause in civil engineering known for the collapses. That's absolutely definitive, and it's beyond a reasonable doubt, I think, establishing that fire alone cannot be shown to have been the definitive cause of the collapse. And you can argue that point very well. Trying to go around that and say what was the cause of it if it wasn't fire is difficult. And that's where it starts to get into.
Just bear in mind that the scholars, for example, have spent a huge amount of time on this. I have two dozen reasons that are based in physics, principally, that disprove the government's account. Maybe that's where you want to draw the line. I mean, all this gets into the melting point of steel, the highest temperature a jet-based fuel fire can attain. The steel was certified by Underwriters Laboratory to such a temperature for such a period of time that the fires were at much lower temperature for much briefer time. The rate of the time that was consumed in the destruction of these buildings versus free fall, all that sort of thing, it has been laid out in spades. So that's one issue. And I tend to agree, and I frequently said, that activists ought to emphasize all of our disproofs, all of our evidence that the government's account can't possibly be correct. Then there's the other alternative of trying to explain what actually happened. This is where thermite, thermate, RDX, lasers, masers, plasmoids, all that come into play. So I take it what you're suggesting is basically the same point I have made to 9/11 activists, namely, focus on the disproofs, the reputations of the government's account, and then acknowledge, of course, that we're trying to figure out what happened, but that's a very difficult, messy business, and we haven't quite sorted it out yet. Is that basically your position?
Well, yeah, my position is, where possible, stick to the... I take the O.J. Simpson case as a classic case in point, where somebody seems to have walked after committing a crime. But if you go into a court of law and you have some dodgy evidence, such as somebody planted a glove, well, unfortunately, the whole lot of your case ends up getting thrown out by the jury. And that's the danger for us, that any time we depart from firm ground, we start compromising our own position, and that's precisely the areas the mainstream media will concentrate on. But I'd like to say as well that I'm not here to take sides in the division in the former unified organization, SK911. That's not my place. And in fact, I think that it's evidence, really, of a divide-and-conquer mechanism at play. And I'm not saying who pulled the divide-and-conquer stunt, but I think that 9/11 activists have got to be more focused on their own resources and analyzing the evidence themselves, and less reliant on the so-called media.
Do you agree that figuring out what happened, in fact, isn't a legitimate objective of 9/11 research?
Oh, I think it is, yes. It's just not, I wouldn't regard it as the primary stuff we should go to the mainstream media with. We go with the good, hard stuff where we've got really a good basis.
Bear in mind, Fenton, we don't go to the mainstream media except when we release press releases. They come to us, you know. I mean, we get invited onto shows at the decision of the media. If I'm on Hannity and Combs, it's not because I wanted to be on Hannity and Combs. It's because they invited me to make an appearance. So, I mean, it's very much driven by the media as to who or what happens to be featured at any point in time. But if in the course of doing the objective scientific research on what actually happened, we're considering or exploring different hypotheses, it's very easy to ridicule them or to, caricature them in ways that are beyond our control, because it's dishonest to what's going on with respect to the nature of scientific inquiry.
Yeah. Well,
that means we're vulnerable in ways, even when we're doing perfectly legitimate scientific research.
I appreciate that, and we encountered some criticism from some people on the forum when we even looked at the issue of esoteric or weapons that are not in the public domain. But let me just finish off some of the planks of this disinformation issue and then come back to some of the issues that you're touching on there.
Sure.
And you mentioned the media. And one of the other problems we have, and I've identified some key areas, I just leave it to people to make their own judgments. Who's pointing us in the wrong direction towards cardboard cutout figures? Who's using divide and conquer? Who's contaminating the evidence pool with flaky evidence? And who's wasting our time? But also, who's dragging us into loopy 9/11 territory? And as a classic case in point there, I point to an appearance by Jimmy Walter on Penn & Teller. Now, previously in 2004, Jimmy Walter, who has been a funder of 9/11 Truth, had said in response to a question on that CNN interview, Anderson Cooper, in 2004, a question about what had happened to the passengers in the plane that supposedly hit the Pentagon. And Jimmy Walter replied, and I'm quoting him now, "Well, I don't know. And I'm not the person to ask this. I don't have the best evidence." That's fair ground, firm ground. He's doing a good job, it seems, on behalf of the 9/11 movement. However, when it came to 2005 and he spoke to Penn & Teller, here's what he said in relation to the same issue of the passengers on the plane that hit the Pentagon. He said, and I'm quoting again, "I firmly believe that many of the alleged passengers on the alleged hijacked aircraft are still alive And quite frankly, I think they were probably all working for the government. Now, that just destroyed us. You want to see what Penn and Teller did with that kind of comment, and in terms of how the families might think that their deceased or missing loved ones have been working with the government. I mean, that destroyed us.
Jimmy Walter entitled to have his opinion, Fitton. I mean, you might disagree with it, I might disagree, but is he entitled to have it?
Well, I tell you what he's not entitled to do. He's not entitled to express a coherent, sensible opinion in 2004 and then on exactly the same issue express what is clearly a lunatic opinion that all the passengers were working for the government and they're all still alive in 2005. That's where I begin to suspect that I'm being set up by Jimmy Walter, frankly.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Fitton Dunn. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays. And I'm here Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Today my special guest is Fitton Dunn from Ireland, and we're talking about issues of information, misinformation, and disinformation in 9/11 research. Fitton, I very much want you to have the opportunity to complete your discussion of the five legs. I must say that when I look at your rogues gallery of 9/11 rats, you know, I see some familiar faces there in people in whom I have great confidence. And when I look at your long list, you know, of CIA fakes for websites, I mean, I've identified probably 20 of those where I would take rather strong exception with your listing them that way. So I don't know if we'll get there, because I want you to have the opportunity to present your views as much as time will permit. I just wanted to mention that I do have some reservations about some of your identifications.
Yeah, well, that's no problem. I you know, everybody's entitled to make their own judgments. I've concentrated tonight on pointing out the trends and tactics and techniques, and then let people see, you know, who's steering them the wrong way and make their own judgments on them.
Uh-huh.
I would point to one of the issues in terms of steering us the wrong way and the kind of games that's been played. We've seen some very interesting and leading figures take a position on the 9/11 issue, and I'm thinking in particular of Michael Meacher, who sat at cabinet with Tony Blair in the United Kingdom, and also Andreas von Bülow, who had defense responsibilities in the German government. And both of those individuals have come forward and expressed doubts in relation to 9/11. I'm not convinced of the bona fides of individuals such as that. In particular, I point to the fact that both of these have appeared on Alex Jones' show. And whatever you might say about Alex Jones, you'd have to admit that he is, at the very least, a controversial figure with some very controversial opinions. Now, normally, politicians don't really, they don't touch that with a 40-foot pole, to be quite honest, Jim. A politician, and Michael Meacher, by the way, has recently been mentioned as a possible contender in the succession stakes to Tony Blair. Now, it's political suicide for a savvy politician not to express doubts on 9/11, but to start expressing those doubts, for example, on Alex Jones' show, where he's really going out on a limb. And so I'm wondering if in fact these are genuine convictions on behalf of these individuals, or if in fact, I suspect, they're actually running cover for the establishment.
Well, when it comes to having controversial views, I mean, God knows I'm in that same category. Alex Jones organized the American Scholars Symposium, where during the panel discussion, which would subsequently be broadcast by C-SPAN, Steve Jones, Bob Bowman, Webster Tarpley, and I were the members, the participants of the panel with Alex, and we were there because we share his concerns about 9/11, not all of his views about other issues. Well, it seems to me that in a lot of ways, his other views about the bigger picture are not so far removed from some of those of your own. So, you know, it's business about being controversial. I mean, Von Bülow was an early recruit as a member of Scholars, and I was very glad that he was willing to take a stand. You also put in there Thierry Meissen. I mean, Thierry Meissen has been, in my opinion, quite brilliant in doing research on the Pentagon. His early books on Pentagate, 9/11, the big lies, were very instrumental in drawing me into serious research about 9/11. Wayne Manson is another person that you know, I'm familiar with, who seems to me to be by and large doing good work, and where I wonder whether he really belongs on your list. But I appreciate your right to have your own rogues gallery. I'm just not sure that I, you know, would include the same persons if I had a list of my own.
Yeah. Well, you know, in terms of Alex Jones and what Alex is talking about, it's more the tone and the tenor in which he presents his views rather than anything else, which can lead to him being perceived as somebody who has extreme views on subjects.
Well, that's the way BBC tried to pitch it, you know, when they featured him and Dylan Avery and me. I mean, they were giving Alex as kind of the evangelical, you know, the passionate minister who was, you know, bringing his congregation around. But that was a deliberate slant they were given. They weren't in any of those cases giving our reasons for holding the views we do about 9/11. Instead, they were presenting us as figures for analysis by others who are going to explain from the point of view of psychology why people like us could be taken in and would hold these beliefs, featuring, for example, a writer for the X-Files who ridiculously suggested that we needed these conspiracy theories as a form of security blanket, as though anyone derives security from the belief that their government has been committing mass murder on their fellow citizens. I mean, I thought the whole program from a general point of view was an absurdity, but it was a nice piece of propaganda for the BBC to be promoting and distributing to the world.
Yeah, well, I mean, Alex is certainly entitled to his opinion and entitled to express his opinion. I'm just pointing out the counterpoint between opinion strongly expressed, as he does, and the normal political savvy of a political operator who attempt to steer clear of any area where he could be subsequently portrayed to his political detriment by opponents of his politically. And that's what causes me questions.
But the alternative would be that actually they are engaging in acts of political courage. I mean, that's the alternative interpretation, is it not? So, I mean, you may have good reasons for why you question that, but I certainly think that that's the alternative I myself would be inclined to endorse.
Okay, well, we have different opinions on that, and that's fine. You mentioned the work of Wayne Madsen, and I do question that, because in the 2004 election, Wayne Madsen popped up with a story which led to considerable ridicule. He was ridiculed by Keith Olbermann, for example, where he was talking about a $29 million payoff check which had been used to steal the election. The check never materialized. The story ended up being vaporware. But it wasn't the first time that Wayne had given us a bum steer electorally, because prior to the election, he was talking about an impending attack on Iran. If you remember, there was a lot of psychological warfare games played in the lead-up to the 2004 election, indicating that either Osama bin Laden was going to be found by the Pentagon, or alternatively that Bush was going to stage some kind of an invasion of Iran in order to steal the election, or come up with some other, maybe another 9/11 attack to steal the election. All of these were essentially disinformation. He didn't use any of those tactics.
Well, but remember, they can be false and not be disinformation. They're only disinformation if you're offering those views knowing that they're false. None of us knew those were false. I was offering opinions like that myself. And you know, I mean, I sincerely believe them, and they therefore weren't disinformation, because you have to not believe. You have to know what you're saying is false. So I'd say you may be a little hasty here in classifying some of these instances as instances of disinformation.
Yeah, well, you know, all I'm doing is going on what Wayne Madsen had published on the issue. And what I'm saying, yeah. let me just explain exactly what I mean by
sure.
CIA faith. I said that quite clearly in the article. I said that some of these sites are simply rehashing and regurgitating intelligence agency sourced information and not realizing what they're doing. Others are quite knowingly and quite deliberately spreading that information. I was just saying these are sites that I no longer feel I can rely on, because they're either doing it deliberately or they're doing it unknowingly. And whatever it was, Wayne Madsen was reporting on October the 20th, 2004, that according to his insiders, the Bush administration was preparing an imminent strike. And his headline was, Bush pre-election strike on Iran, imminent.
Well, I just tell you, Fenton, I recently had six experts on Iran on my program on three consecutive days, devoted 6 hours to this, and I became convinced in relation to that, and especially perhaps the work of Webster Tarpley in relation to this, that an imminent an attack on Iran was indeed imminent. And I said so then, that it was in relation to, I think it was the phase of the moon. Maybe it had to do with the 17th of February, that was the date that I was expecting this might happen. I'm just telling you, there's a lot of evidence out there that tends to support that belief, and I've been inclined toward it myself, and yet it was manifestly not disinformation, because what I was saying was something I absolutely believed and had good reason for offering.
Let me tell you how it will be.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays. My special guest today is Fenton Dunn from Ireland. And Fenton, I want to give you the rest of the show to tell us all the things that you haven't been able to say. I know time has been, a precious and limited commodity. Please do complete your impressions of what's going on here.
Okay. Well, you know, I'd like to turn to some of the issues that I see as, diversionary and which have taken us in the wrong direction, and maybe turn to some personalities closer to home to the situation that you found yourself in with scholars. As I say, I'm not here to defend Jim Fetzer or take sides with Jim Fetzer, and I'm sure you appreciate that. But I do have concerns in terms of the role that Stephen Jones has played in the 9/11 movement. And those concerns go back to something that you alluded to yesterday, which was his role in the Cold Fusion controversy, which took place when Pons and Fleischmann came forward with their announcement that they were getting more energy out of a cold fusion process than you would expect by normal physical means. Now, Stephen Jones's intervention, in fact, he was the person who peer-reviewed their initial paper on that issue, and he was effectively shadowing their research, and he had a catastrophic impact on what they came forward with, because he was working in a similar field, and yet what he said was that he was finding nothing like the results they were finding. He portrayed cold fusion as being really a dead-end technology, which was an interesting artifact and nothing more and nothing less. In fact, he used the words, read my lips, when he denounced Pons and Fleischmann. However, in the intervening period, cold fusion research has gone from strength to strength as much as it can in an era where it has been blacklisted by all of the reputable university and other research institutions around the world because of that controversy. So I'm concerned that Stephen Jones set back an alternative to fossil fuels by maybe 15 to 20 years by the role that he played at that time. And that just causes me to have some caution in terms of how I view his role currently in the 9/11 movement. So I'm at one with you in terms of having those concerns that you expressed about his role in that area previously.
Yeah.
But also as an equal opportunity critic of the 9/11 issue, I must say also that you referred to the work that Judy Wood had done. And, I'm concerned that I don't find sufficient substance in what Judy Wood is putting forward. Much of our debate on this issue that we had in the Break for News .com forum was looking at what the nature of these weapons might be and some practical physics methodology that could be applied, to deploy them, and that would be consistent with what we saw on the day, and that would not leave a trace, and that would not be picked up, etc., etc. In other words, we had to at least come up with some kind of a substantive basis of the nature of such a weapon, and that's not beyond us. It's not beyond our capabilities. We know there are certain types of technologies that could be deployed, and we can certainly make informed guesses as to the kind of weaponry that might be used. But I find that that level of detail is missing from what Judy is saying, and she's instead relying on some observational evidence. Am I right in characterizing her evidence that way and being very weak in terms of what was actually used?
No, I think the evidence is really disconfirmatory of the use of conventional modes of destruction, and is an invitation to consider non-conventional modes of destruction. I mean, when you look at the the concentration of the damage to just the buildings that had WTC designations. When you look at the enormous gouges out of Building 6, for example, when you look at the cookie-cutter kinds of holes in Building 5, when you see half of Building 4 is completely demolished and the other half is remaining more or less intact, when you see Building 3 has this huge gash in it, when you look at the non-functional damage to the bathtub, when you look at the toasted cars, and then when you look at the residue from Hangar 17 at JFK, when you look at these meteor-like compressions of metal and steel, and you see the bent steel and all that, it's overwhelmingly evident to me from looking at this evidence, which we can refer to as hard evidence, that she has archived at her site, drjudywood.com, that I see no possibility that thermite, thermate, RDX could account for this. And I just see no way in which you can explain what we have to explain, technically known as the explanandum, based upon conventional modes. Now, she hasn't committed herself to what precise type of non-conventional mode was involved here, but I think she's absolutely right that we have to be open-minded, because it's apparent to me from reviewing this evidence that non-conventional modes of destruction of one sort or another were used here.
Yeah, well, I'd just like to see some working through of that into at least some scientifically informed discussion of that. I mean, it's not beyond us. The technology of these kinds of weapon systems is not entirely unknown, and there's certainly well-informed speculation on the nature of these, and there's good physics principles underlying it, etc. I just find it's weak at the very end.
Well, but then she has some very precise calculations, for example, about the amount of dust that would be generated by the dustification of the pulverization of the buildings, and it seems to be approximately correct. I mean, most of those buildings was turned into very fine dust. Now, that's not something that can be done by thermite, thermate, or RDX. So far as I can see, it's an impossibility that these buildings could have been destroyed the way they were using conventional modes of destruction. So I think she's got a very sound scientific case. See, if you study your site, there are calculations about many different aspects of this. I mean, remember, she's a very sophisticated student of these matters with degrees in civil engineering and engineering mechanics and materials engineering science.
Yeah, well, I'd like her to concentrate on those areas, and that's what I just found is a bit speculative when she's not substantiating it with a type of weaponry. But anyway, that's just a critic, you know, just how I view that issue. When I start to draw links between different individuals, and I'm looking at where individuals have appeared on fora together, and I'm looking at who is pushing certain information, who's picking it up, who's running with the ball, that's where I start to tie together what I call the CIA fakes, and where I get my rat's nest listing from is, for example, when I find a guy like General Ivashov appearing at an Axis of Peace meeting in Brussels. And this is a guy who's a former head of the Russian Armed Forces now, just to put it in context. And he's sitting there alongside 9/11 skeptics. And I'm just wondering to myself, if you really get, imagine, for example, a former U.S. chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at a 9/11 truth meeting, and you have the picture that I'm trying to put together in my brain as to how it could possibly be that this extremely dubious-looking individual who headed the Russian Armed Forces is supposedly a 9/11 skeptic, and which informs my view that a number of key political and, indeed in this case, a military figure, are running cover for the G8 to ensure that if there is to be discussion of the 9/11 issue, that it's steered in the correct direction. And so I just question it when I see people sitting down with the likes of General Ivashov, or, for example, I question, as I have, Wayne Matson. I don't care whether he's still NSA or ex-NSA, if I can see that he's been ending up putting out bad information about, for example, the Iran attack, which has got to be imminent now for about 4 years or at least 3.5 years. I mean, how imminent is imminent, Jim? When do you reach the point where you start to put two and two together and realize that this is part of the total news management cycle that these people have, and that they've beaten us to death with this Iran invasion issue, when there are substantive reasons to believe that the whole reason they went into Iraq in the first place in confidence was knowing the Iranians were on side and weren't going to ambush them in the south of the country, leaving them only the sunning in the north to deal with, and that's the political reality behind the scenes, and that all of this Iran invasion stuff is completely dubious because the Iranian leadership are on board and have been on board ever since the Iranian revolution was engineered by Western intelligence, knowing that the Shah was about to fall. So, you know, that's a clear, substantive position, and those are the kind of basis that I'm using to reach my determinations on this, and all I can do is say to people to check it out themselves and make their own conclusions, but follow the logic I'm using. Who's pointing you in the wrong direction? Who's dividing and conquering? Who's contaminating the evidence pool? Who's wasting your time? Who's dragging you into loopy 9/11 areas? And then draw your own conclusions from that.
Well, Susan, I'm very pleased to have had the chance to have you on. And I'm fascinated by your take on all these things. And whether I agree or disagree, it's a great value to me and I think to everyone else engaged in 9/11 research to have such a distinctive, original point of view that requires us to reassess our views about a lot of things that we may have taken for granted, some of them perfectly inadvertently and in passing. So I'm very glad to have had this chance to have you on. And I'd be inclined to think at some point down the road that we ought to do it again.
Okay, well, I certainly welcome the non-emotional tone of our discussion and the logical and reasonable tone of our discussion, Jim. It's been great to be on the show.
Let me just say thanks again to my special guest, Nitin Dunn. This has been Jim Fetzer, your host on From the Dynamic Duo. Thank you for listening.